Australian Peter Singer is a professor of philosophy, often cited as the world's most influential living philosopher, and also one of the most controversial. He's a professor at Princeton University. His work on the ethics of our treatment of animals is credited with starting the modern animal rights movement. He wrote a book called Animal Liberation back in 1975. He's also a key figure in the development of effective altruism, meaning that people should try to reduce suffering in the most effective manner possible. Broadly speaking, he's a proponent of utilitarianism, the greatest good of the greatest number. Professor Singer was due to speak at Auckland Sky City in June, but the gig was cancelled by the venue because his long-standing views on the rights of parents to euthanise newborn children with severe disabilities made the casino fear, it said, reputational damage. Professor Singer was coming here to promote his book on charitable giving and alleviation of poverty. He donates 40% of his income to charity. But the outcry from disabled people has put that in the shade. He's with me now from Australia. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're accustomed to protests. You've been faced with protests for decades over your position on euthanizing infants with severe disabilities. Is this your first cancellation?
No, it's not. I know that one of the New Zealand media published that, and maybe the organiser of the event was a bit mistaken about that. But I have had events cancelled before. I think it's the first press by a commercial venue. I've had events cancelled by universities that had some pressure, and I think my very first cancellation, I was invited to a conference in Germany organized by the parents of children with disabilities, but one element in that organization didn't want to hear me speak, so that, I think that was the first of them. So a couple of conferences like that and universities, but it does seem strange for me to for a commercial venue to cancel me. And also, this is the first cancellation, I think, in an English-speaking country where I think there's rather more tolerance. You can understand why some people in Germany are very sensitive about issues relating to euthanasia. But I was rather surprised that this should happen in New Zealand.
Since you've gone there, let's stay there. In Euthanasia Emerging from Hitler's Shadow, which you wrote years ago, you explained why your belief was distinguished from Nazism, which aimed to eliminate the useless in broad terms, because you have been accused of following the Nazis in this. What's the difference?
Well, firstly, I find it quite a bizarre accusation, given that my parents came to Australia as Jewish refugees from the Nazis. And sadly, my grandparents did not leave in time, and three of them were murdered by the Nazis. Only one survived. So I'm very far from giving any support at all to those horrendous ideas. The difference, though, really, is that I'm suggesting that parents should have the ability to make decisions that they judge to be in the best interest of their child and of their family, whereas the Nazis, of course, had this racist ideology that people with disabilities were kind of a blot on the Aryan folk, I think they called them useless mouths. And wanted to get rid of them for that reason.
The difference you make in Emerging from Hitler's Shadow is that the idea of a life not worthy to be lived is not the same as the idea of a life not worth living.
That's quite correct, yes. There was an issue, I think, in when I was speaking in Germany that phrase had been mistranslated in one of my books, where I'd said, you know, a life can be not worth living from the point of view of the child or person living that life. If a life is full of suffering, they may think it's not worth living, or the parents in the case of an infant may think that it's not worth living. Whereas I think the phrase the Nazis used was better translated as a life unworthy of being lived, which again, as I say, is unworthy by those standards of what you expect an Aryan people to be, to have this, you know, more genetic sort of like purebred, avoid these malformations. I think that it's not a question of disability, it's a question of quality of life that we should be talking about entirely.
Is it correct that you would include newborns with Down syndrome, spina bifida and haemophilia?
So, in general, I think that parents sort of make those decisions. I'm not going to set the standards. I think parents and their circumstances ought to be the ones making those decisions. The reference to haemophilia is a bit misleading, and obviously treatments for various conditions have advanced since I first talked about these issues something like more than 30 years ago. I was talking about haemophilia in the context of suggesting that haemophilia was then a reason for terminating a pregnancy. And in fact, because at that time you couldn't really tell whether a child had haemophilia, but you might know that you're at genetic risk of having a child with haemophilia. And overwhelmingly, it's almost only males who have haemophilia. So the standard practice was that women were terminating their male fetuses and selecting only female fetuses. So that doesn't happen anymore because you can detect haemophilia. But my point was, if parents thought that this was so serious that they would not have any male children, then another option would be to wait until the infant was born, and then you could do a test to see whether there was haemophilia. And in some ways that might be an alternative that some parents might choose. But as I say, I was not suggesting that they make that choice, but rather saying that that was a possible choice that some parents might prefer.
Am I quoting you correctly when I say that you have written, a life should be based on rationality, autonomy and self-consciousness. Defective infants lack those characteristics. Killing them cannot be equated with killing normal human beings or any other self-conscious beings.
Well, that must be a quote that is almost 40 years old, because the term defective human being was one that was then being used, was then the normal sort of term for people born with disabilities. And then it became regarded as an unacceptable term, as terminology often does change. So I may have said that. I don't remember the exact words, but I could have said something very like that 30 or 40 years ago, but that wouldn't be a quote from anything I'd written,
but the meaning
more recently than that.
But the meaning remains the same.
Well, not that I think that my view would not be that I say you start off by saying a life worth living. That's, as I said, nothing that I'm judging, and I don't think even then I would have actually put it quite like that. I'd be surprised if I did, and certainly I wouldn't today. I would rather say that those are characteristics that people might use in deciding whether a life is worth living, that parents might use to make that decision. But I would have thought, you know, the happiness, enjoyment, absence of suffering today, I would certainly give a lot more emphasis to that. So my position has shifted over the years in that respect.
So if we look specifically at Down's syndrome, which you have mentioned, Down syndrome people, which you accept, have a happy life, are often very happy indeed. Would that be included in disability that might qualify for neonatal death?
Well, normally I would think you would hope to find parents who would adopt a child who can have a happy life, who's not going to have a life of suffering. So that would normally be the situation, I think, in societies like, you know, Australia or New Zealand, European societies, as far as Down syndrome is concerned. But there are some cultures. In fact, I've been emailing with somebody from New Zealand about this. There are cultures in which that's not the case, in which people with Down syndrome are regarded much more negatively than we regard it, and where the future might be quite grim if the parents themselves don't feel that they can love and rear such a child. And possibly then that's something that one might consider.
So you
just,
accept
just,
that...
You know, to put this...
Yeah, yeah. Carry on.
Sorry, can I just say, it's very, very common, of course, for pregnant women, especially pregnant women who are somewhat older, to have tests for whether their fetus will have Down syndrome or whether the fetus is affected by the Down syndrome chromosomal abnormality. And the overwhelming majority of women who have a positive result for that test do terminate the pregnancy. So there is clearly a, even in Australia, New Zealand and similar countries, there is clearly a feeling that people would much rather have a child, much rather not have a child with Down syndrome. And I don't, you know, the one thing that I agree with for people who are opposed to abortion is that there's not a very sharp difference between ending the life of a child in utero and ending the life of a child within days after birth. So to that extent, I could think that if somebody was, you know, determined not to have a child with Down syndrome and would have terminated that pregnancy had they had the test, and if they want to make that same decision immediately after birth, and if there's no family willing and keen to bring up that child, to adopt that child and give that child a good life, it doesn't seem to me very far from something that we pretty routinely accept, that is the termination of Down syndrome fetuses during pregnancy.
You think it's irrational then that decisions about fetuses are not seen in the same light as decisions about babies after birth?
With the only difference being that a baby who's been born can more easily be given up for adoption, not that easily necessarily, there's sometimes emotional difficulties, but the woman doesn't have to go through the rest of pregnancy and birth. So that's a significant difference. But in terms of the moral status of the entity, I don't think birth makes such a difference. It's a difference of location, but in terms of the awareness of the fetus or child, you know, they're no more aware of their life. They're no more capable of deciding for themselves. They're no more capable of thinking about their future immediately after birth than they are, let's say, at 6 months of gestation in utero.
So at what point in the life of a child does it become immoral to consider euthanizing it if it is severely disabled?
Well, I think I now think that does depend on the nature of the condition, but also, you know, clearly once a child is in any way able to have views on this issue, then it's the child's or the adult's view, you know, the developing person's view, decision to make entirely. So, you know, what I've said is that I think generally these decisions should be taken as soon as possible after birth. And that would, say, be in the first month after birth. But it's difficult, I agree. You know, this is one of the objections that people make to my view, of course. It's difficult to draw a sharp line, and birth does provide a sort of line and some clarity. But
I don't think that's with all due respect, I don't think that's the main objection that people have towards your thinking on this one.
The question is, what is it? What do they think about? Why do they think that birth makes such a crucial difference if it's not either the ease of giving up the child for adoption or the fact that it's perhaps the only place where there's a clear and sharp line that the law could draw?
Well, I mean, it is very utilitarian, but you're sort of making the child a commodity in that argument.
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that's quite wrong. It has nothing to do with selling.
Hang on. If you're measuring the worth of a child in terms of whether it could easily be accepted by adoptive parents, then you're merely putting a market value, albeit a social market value.
No. Come on. If you're talking about a market, you're talking about prices. And I'm not talking about selling affecting children. The point about, excuse me, the
No,
point
you
about
must
adoption
get
is
that
that we don't,
point.
excuse me, could you let me finish, please?
Yeah.
The point about adoption is that we don't anymore put these children into institutions, and rightly not. And if you adopt, if a child is adopted by a loving family, the child's prospects for having a good life, for enjoying being looked after, are far better than if the child is not adopted. That's the entirely point, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with commodification.
I
That's why I
completely
feel.
understand that point. But if you have a society in which a Down syndrome child is loved and respected, then there won't be any problem with adoption. If you have a society.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why I said I don't think that this is a real problem in New Zealand or Australia or other societies. But I was pointing out that there are some cultures in which that is not the case. And in fact, I had an email 2 days ago from a New Zealander. I think he's in Kenya, saying exactly that, that things are very different there.
If you are arguing this on the basis of suffering, the least suffering for the least number of people, the suffering that you assume will be experienced by the disabled, is part of that suffering not due to the stigma that your critics accuse you of reinforcing?
Well, I certainly think there is stigma, and yes, that does increase the suffering of people with disabilities. I think that's true. But I don't think, you know, if in fact the majority of women who have a child with Down syndrome who detect that during pregnancy are going to terminate that pregnancy, then these are attitudes that are obviously quite widespread in our society, and I don't think it really helps to push them under the carpet and not discuss these issues. But by the way, talking about reinforcing this, the whole reason we're having this discussion is because some New Zealanders protested against my coming to New Zealand and the venue cancelled it. I was not going to talk about disability in New Zealand, so I was not raising this topic. These are issues that, as we've said, I wrote about 30 years ago, and I haven't really spoken very much about them recently, you know, or over the last 20 or 30 years, except when people protest and I defend the views, which I still think have some sound basis. I'm not prepared to say I'm not going to talk about this now when I'm attacked for it. But my interest, as you correctly said in your introduction, was to talk about helping people in extreme poverty in developing countries and to raise money for the non-profit that I founded to do that. So, you know, if people don't want this issue talked about, then they're making a bad mistake in trying to get venues to cancel my events.
No, that's...
And by the way, I will be coming to New Zealand. We have had, since this cancellation, we've already had 3 offers of alternative venues in Auckland. So I will be speaking about effective altruism and in Auckland, and I hope people will come along and listen to what I say on that topic.
Are you able to tell me where you'll be speaking?
Not quite, because the contracts have not yet been signed, but it will be quite a large venue that we're thinking that we've been offered in Auckland.
I do understand that you feel that you are forced to speak about something that you have moved on from. But how much have you moved on from it? You indicated a little earlier that the phrasing would be different were you to write about it today. But it does seem to be consistent with your philosophy, and you can't eschew it. Is it that you don't want to talk about it anymore?
Yes, it's significantly what you said, that I am concerned that talking about it will reinforce attitudes against people with disabilities, which I certainly don't want to do. And I think the issues that I am talking about, both the topic of extreme poverty and what we can do about that, and also topics about the treatment of animals, which I've been writing about also for more than 40 years, and I think is a major problem. I also talk about climate change and how we're failing to grapple with that. I think that these are much larger and more significant issues. And that's why I've focused on those questions for at least the last 25 years anyway.
Do you mind if I make the observation that for somebody so focused on suffering and the least suffering for the least number, you seem remarkably deaf to the idea that what you say could cause suffering.
No, I'm not deaf to, about that at all. That's what I just said, I think, that I haven't talked about this issue very much over the last 25 years, precisely because I think that, you know, that it, this can have some negative effects. And as I said, I think the other issues are much more important, affect much larger numbers of people in much more severe ways. So I think I am listening to what people are saying and choosing not to focus on a topic which was much more at the center of my work and writing in the 1980s and perhaps early 1990s.
Are you saying that you regret your views on neonatal euthanasia?
Look, it's hard to regret a view that you still think is actually a sound view, but perhaps I regret having
nearly dug yourself out, that. You just threw yourself back in there again. Because, as you said, times change.
No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I'm not going to go back on arguments that I still think are sound arguments. But
right.
You're raising the question of whether it's wise or whether it's inconsistent.
No, what I'm asking
you to talk about these issues.
I'm asking
and
you.
And I recognise that as a real question.
I'm asking you whether, with the passage of time and the decades that have passed since you first formulated that view, you might be prepared to change your mind within the context of your utilitarian beliefs and your effective altruism.
But you see, you can't change your mind because on those things because you think that it would have been better not to have talked about them. That you can only change your mind on the basis of arguments that show that the position is actually wrong.
Well, here's an argument that's been put through to me, is that you are wrong to think that disabled people cannot have a life worth living.
I've never said that. I've never claimed that disabled people cannot have a life worth living. That's far too broad a statement, and I've never made such a statement.
So you are saying what?
I'm saying that many disabled people, probably most, you know, that's such a broad term, by the way. I mean, you know,
of course,
can be disabled because you need to walk with a stick or something. But, you know, I was talking about people born with severe life-changing disabilities of a different kind. But I am saying that there are some disabilities so severe that they are incompatible with a life worth living. I think it's pretty obvious to most people if you think about the most severe disabilities, which, for example, might mean that somebody is not even able to smile at their mother, not able to feed themselves, never can walk or get out of bed or anything like that. I think it's pretty obvious that there are some disabilities that are incompatible with a life worth living.
And as we said before, it's difficult to know where to draw that line.
Yes, absolutely. But still, lines have to be drawn, even if they're difficult.
And you're suggesting that it should be the parents who draw the line?
The parents, when they're well informed. And information can come from doctors, but I also think, and this is something that I've added since I first began writing about this, I think that if we're talking about a condition like Down syndrome, then parents ought to get information from organizations of parents of children with Down syndrome, who will, of course, give them a much more positive view than doctors often do. And I think a more realistic view based on more experience. So I think the parents should be fully informed about this from a variety of perspectives. But then when they are fully informed, yes, I would allow them to make the final decision.
Can you define utilitarianism for me in your terms?
Utilitarianism is the view that the right act is the one that has the best consequences, and that by best consequences we mean the consequences for the well-being or happiness, you know, surplus of happiness over misery, that all of those affected by the action will have.
It seems a remarkably data-driven belief.
And would you prefer a belief that doesn't take account of the facts? Because when you say data-driven, you're talking about the facts about the world we're living in. I think our ethical views should be determined by the facts about what consequences our actions will have. I would hate people to have ethical views that were indifferent to the consequences that their actions will have in the world in which we're living.
Is there any place for empathy?
Of course, empathy is a way of understanding what the facts of our actions are. If we lack empathy, then we are being indifferent to the fact that our actions may cause great suffering to people.
And your famous child drowning in the puddle argument. I'm just thinking about a recent statement you've made about how Australians could find better things to do with their charitable donations than give it to drought-stricken farmers. It all comes down to empathy, doesn't it? I might know
Yes,
those,
exactly.
I might know those farmers, I identify with those farmers, I want to give my money. So you're trying to counteract those empathetic instincts, are you not?
I'm trying to extend our empathy to people who are further from us, but whose lives are much harder than the lives of Australian farmers, who, after all, are living in an affluent country where they get various kinds of social support, where they don't have to walk 2 hours a day to get water to drink, and they don't have to boil the water because it's safe to drink as it comes out of the tap, where they can go to a hospital if they're ill and get excellent medical care, where they don't have to worry about whether they can educate their children. I think we need to have empathy for people who are further away from us and whose lives are much more in peril than the lives of Australian farmers affected by drought.
So many sums one would have to do to work out what to do to
Yes,
live
it's a
a moral
complicated
life.
world, isn't it? I agree.
It's a very complicated world. I mean, should I give one of my kidneys up because I only need one?
Well, I have some embarrassment in answering that question because I still have two kidneys, but actually, I think the answer is yes. Given that there are people on waiting lists for kidneys who have very tough qualities of life because they have to undergo dialysis and some of them die while waiting for a transplant, and given that the risks to you or to me of donating a kidney are actually very small, I think I would be a better person if I did donate one of my kidneys, and I think you would be too.
Are you thinking about it?
Well, I have thought about it, but for one thing, I'm in my 70s now, and people think that that's maybe a little bit old for doing this. Probably should have done it long ago. I greatly admire many people who I have been in contact with, and some who I've met, younger people in their 20s who've donated a kidney. I think that's a wonderful thing to do. But I have to admit, personally, no, I'm not about to do that.
Good to talk to you. Thank you. Professor Peter Singer, who was cancelled by Sky City, but now is coming to another venue, as yet unspecified.